Good afternoon. And I first want to express what's in my heart being with you all, and that is a lot of appreciation, a lot of gratitude. I think it's from my own life experience and being a teacher that I have tremendous belief and value in what we're all doing here. And for all of you to be giving yourself to this for today, I appreciate it a lot. I don't assume that it's easy, but I do believe it's extremely worthwhile. And part of the reason it's not easy is that many of us will have all kinds of momentum in our lives, in our minds, in our hearts, which makes it hard to sit still and be quiet and just be somehow deeply settled at peace in this moment here. And so the idea of just being is hard if the mind is used to doing. The idea of having some kind of radical acceptance is hard if the mind is mostly involved in not accepting things. The idea of sitting without attaining anything is hard if the mind is, you know, driven by the idea of attainment and getting something and getting somewhere. If to sit here and not be entertained is hard for people who are used to being entertained all the time, who have the television on all the time or music on all the time or something always going on. And I have teenagers at home and, you know, it's remarkable. They don't have one thing going on at a time. They have like four or five things happening on different devices and different, I don't know, things, you know, just. And the idea you would stop all the devices and just sit and be here on your own is quite a radical thing. And it could be frightening for some people. It could certainly give birth to boredom for some people. It could be kind of unacceptable even to do this, and you might end up being like Max, who has to leave the retreat for brunch. I don't recommend it. I think that's what he was telling you the story, was to save you from that, having to do that. But it's a radically different thing, but the rewards of it are phenomenal. The rewards of being at peace with yourself, being at peace with the moment, is just kind of the surface, but more deeply we discover a very different way of connecting to the world and living in the world. We discover wellsprings of wisdom, of love, of compassion that makes us, I think, much better citizens of the world, much better members of a community, much more empathic, much more caring, and much more responsible for how we live our lives. And to come to that is one of the great things in life. And to come to it by this radical simplicity of this practice has a lot to do with just things shedding. So shedding the momentums of wanting and non-acceptance or attaining or entertaining or the momentum of boredom. And the mind has so much momentum, it's hard to even know, because sometimes it just seems like we don't even know it's there because it's so regular, it's such an integral part of who we are. And so to do something as radical as a sit and practice all day or for a retreat, that's such a radical shift in how we normally are, we begin to see the momentum. We get to see the contractions, we get to see the fears, we get to see the desires and the busy mind and see all that stuff. And over time, it begins to shed. And all the extra stuff that we've layered on top of ourselves are shed. And this idea of just being here in a very simple way starts seeming kind of extraordinary after a while because of how much has been shed and how much gets opened up and revealed. That's all here for us in a nice way. So the discourse that Max and I are going to be talking about this week talks about six actions. The Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as principles, but the word probably means actions. And it refers to actions, things we do. Six things that we can do that bring delight. So that's nice. But in particular, it brings delight because it helps create love, respect, concord, togetherness, unity with each other. That it's six actions that kind of are the means by which we have a unified community, and people who are in conflict can heal the conflict and come together. And so these are six delightful qualities. And one of the reasons, so there's six, so we'll go through some of these, and I'll do three of them today. You'll understand why soon. But what's fascinating is that, I mean, it's all very interesting, this teaching, and I'm most delighted by the last one, which connects, which the delightful action we do is has to do with the deep insight that comes from this practice. And that deep insight would seem like, you know, if you sit and meditate and close your eyes and go deep inside and have this deep meditative insight, that isn't that selfish? Isn't that somehow, self-absorbed, and we should be out there helping people and being involved in people? But then, and when he comes to the end, he says, this final delightful action does this. It creates love and respect and is conducive to social cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So here we have this idea that we go deep inside in practice, and we kind of get turned inside out. And in the inside out, we come back, and it does something about our relationship to the world and other people that has this very good effect. And each of these six actually has the same effect, but he goes on to say that this last one is the topmost, and the one that does the most work in this kind of way. And that's also interesting that that if you want, from the Buddhist point of view at least, that the way to most fully help create a cohesive, unified, free of dispute community is to do the inner work in oneself to be liberated. And as opposed to the earlier ones, which are really good to do, but and not to diminish them, but he takes this last one as the chief or the highest, topmost. So there's a little story behind this teaching he gives, and this it opens up a description of the monastic community around the Buddha on a particular occasion. And I'll read you the description of this community, and I'll leave it to you to, maybe there's something that's been happening lately in our kind of, in at least the United States, that some of you might recognize that fits this description pretty well as well. On that occasions, the monastics had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. They could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. Does that sound familiar to any of you? It's a little bit surprised to hear that the community of monastics sitting around the Buddha, being at the Buddha, should be doing verbal daggers at each other and having this level of discord. And I kind of I don't know if inspired is the right word to say by this. I just appreciate how deep the human tendency to conflict is. That even, you know, those people who had the benefit of teachings of the Buddha still would succumb to this kind of tendency. And it's just so human that this is how it is. And the Buddha had to somehow contend with this kind of social challenges of his time as well, like we have to do in ours. So as a result of this, the Buddha called together his monastics to have a talk with him. And he begins by asking them a question. And the question is, is it true that you've taken to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, that you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, that you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others? So he's asked them, you know, so he's heard they're quarreling, and the first good thing to do is not to blame them or be upset, but just find out, is this really true? And I love the answer he gets from them. They just say, yes. I love it that they're so just straightforward. Yes, they don't try to excuse themselves or say, no, not really, or they're doing it, but well, I'm not. They just say yes. So that's so clear and straightforward. And then the Buddha goes on and says, what do you think? When you're doing all that, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you on that occasion maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind in public and in private towards your companions in the holy life? And being kind of straightforward, the monks, they just say, no, we're not. There's no loving kindness, either publicly or privately. I think publicly means, you know, so other people see they're doing it, and privately means, I think, that they don't get any public credit. No, maybe it's done so no one sees that they're even doing it. And so a little bit I see this as the Buddha's expectation that when his monastics are going to live together in community, that they would live together with acts of loving kindness in body, speech, and mind. They would physically do things that express goodwill, verbally express goodwill, and they would, in their own mind, they would have goodwill for others. I think I've been appreciating more the translation of metta as goodwill rather than loving kindness, because loving kindness is a little bit unclear what it means, or it's a very high bar. We're supposed to have love for the people who are really difficult for us or have harmed us, and sometimes it's hard to find love, whatever love is supposed to be. But goodwill, you can have goodwill for people that you don't love. You can have goodwill for people who you have trouble with. You can have some kind of generosity of spirit, generosity of heart towards people who have maybe caused you a lot of harm even. Loving kindness is a little harder to get to, I think, and little ask more questions like, is it appropriate? Is that really what I'm supposed to do? And how do I do that? Goodwill I see as a basic kind of friendliness, a basic willingness to wish them well, and even if it's wishing them well so that they would treat you better. But, you know, this goodwill, willingness, you know, wishing them well, maybe wishing them well because chances are that some of the difficult ways in which they behave is because they're suffering, because they're challenged. So a basic friendliness. Metta is cognate to the Pali word for friend, amitta. So, and then he goes on, and then he says, monastics, there are six actions that lead to delight. And I kind of also love the idea that he's kind of, in a sense, challenged them. You know, you guys have been misbehaving, and now we have it established. In fact, you've been misbehaving, and you're not really acting in the way that the training that we have here is about. We train in goodwill for each other. And then rather than being upset with them, or coming down really stern and hard, he says, well, let me tell you what leads to delight. And it's a kind of different tact to take. Six principles or six actions that lead to delight. First, a monastic maintains bodily acts of loving kindness both in public and in private towards their companions in the holy life. This is an action that leads to delight, that creates love and respect, and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Then the second one is, a monastic maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards one's companions in the holy life. This too is an action that leads to delight, that creates love and respect, and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Again, a monastic maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards their companions in the holy life. This too is an action that leads to delight, that creates love and respect, conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. And so those are the first three of the six actions that the Buddha talks about. And the fourth one is being generous to one's companions, sharing your things with them. And the next one is to be virtuous, to live a virtuous life in relationship to them, with them. And how the Buddha kind of specifies what it means, the effects of virtue and what that's about is kind of interesting, a little different than we would expect. And then the last one is the insight, deep liberating insight that is the foremost of these six actions, all of which lead to love and respect and cohesion and concord and unity. So the first three have to do with loving kindness. And I don't know where it's easiest for you to practice goodwill, whether it's in your actions or in your speech or in just privately in your mind. Some people find it's easiest to do it just in their minds, because it gets complicated when you have to speak to people. And it gets even more complicated when you're actually doing things with people, kind things, and it can be misunderstood or just make the relationship sometimes complicated. At the minimum, we can maybe do it privately in our own mind, in our own hearts. And then they don't have to know about it even. But we relate to them, we think about them, or we in ways that are friendly or generous or has a sense of goodwill in them, wishing them well. And instead of the opposite. And sometimes it's very easy to kind of to have negative thoughts for people and thoughts which are not particularly kind or friendly. And sometimes for the silliest reasons. Someone might look like your mean third grade teacher. The person rubs you the wrong way, everything they do, and so there's very little goodwill, or they're wearing the wrong color socks, or whatever the reason might be. And but to take the time to turn the heart around, to not let the thoughts of ill will dominate, not by overlaying or repressing the ill will, but in the mindfulness tradition, it's by, in a sense, going through the ill will to the other side of it, to the goodwill, to go through it through with mindfulness. And this thing about sitting in your privacy of your own mind, your own heart, and really feeling what's there. And sometimes what's there is not necessarily so solid, inspiring, and something we necessarily will quickly want to share with other people because we're angry or upset or we're, critical, or maybe we have mean thoughts sometimes. And then ideally we'd be just like the monastics when the Buddha asked them, have you been arguing with each other with verbal daggers? And we would just say, yes. do you have a lot of ill will for someone? At least in your own mind, you don't have to admit this publicly, but in your mind you would just say, it's the equivalent of yes. In fact, that's what's happening. As opposed to pretending you're not that way, or trying to avoid it, or just not even paying attention to it, or recognizing you're doing it and then berating yourself or being discouraged about yourself. It's enough just to say, yes, yep, I'm doing it. And that's a great piece of information. Yep. And then, with mindfulness, dip into it. Get to know it better. Where does it live for you in your body, the feelings of ill will? What's the dukkha? What's the stress that you have that comes with having that ill will? What are the associated emotions that come with ill will? There's other emotions which sometimes are the genesis or the very conditions for ill will to arise. One of them is hurt. And it doesn't necessarily mean hurt that something happened today. Sometimes it's hurt that happened, years and years ago. And sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's insecurity. So there's all kinds of things that can be kind of underneath that's motivating. It can be frustration, frustrated desire. And so the reason to say kind of matter-of-factly and simple way, yes, looks like I have ill will, yes, without making it any more complicated than that, is so that then we can drop into it and start discovering what's really here and get to know it and maybe heal that. And some of you might know this saying that came out of St. Quentin. St. Quentin is a state, very famous state prison here in the San Francisco area. It's on an island. No, it's not an island. It's it's near San Francisco. And I go in there regularly, enough. What regularly means about once a year. And there's a saying in San Quentin that hurt people hurt and healed people heal. So some of these prisoners in San Quentin have done some of the worst things people can do to each other. They know about hurt. Turns out that most of them who have done horrible things to others had horrible things done to them, often as children. And so when they say, that saying arose out of those prisoners when they were kind of finally looking at themselves in a deep way. And they said, wait. Actually, two of them said, one gang member said, I'm learning here that hurt people hurt. And then another gang member, ex-gang member, said, yes, and healed people heal. And so if there's ill will, the practice is to, yes, let's bring this mindfulness to it and see. And what you'll probably find is if you really are honest and sit with it without any berating of yourself, without any reactivity to it, but just sit there very calmly, that you might begin to start having some goodwill towards yourself. The act of looking at yourself and wanting to heal yourself is a goodwill, is wishing yourself well, is being your own friend. Let's be a friend here and see what's going on here. It's like you're with a friend who's really having a challenging time, and you go for a walk and say, what's happening with you? Tell me. So in mindfulness, we do the equivalent to ourselves. Hey, friend, what's going on here? Let me know. Show me what's happening. And this way, when we practice loving kindness, when we practice goodwill, when we generate that, then it maybe comes from a more authentic place within. It isn't a sugarcoating the situation or overlaying and repressing or hiding how we feel, but it comes from some that also has a chance to come from someplace deep inside. And that's been one of the great delights for me, great joys for me, is how much in the course of my Buddhist meditation practice, how much it has awoken in me both compassion and goodwill to degrees that I had no idea were possible growing up. And the first for me was compassion. In my first years of Buddhist practice, I did a lot of it in monasteries and things. And I didn't get enlightened, but I got compassioned. And that was pretty good. I was really surprised by this wonderful feeling. And then compassion became the orienting principle of my life. It became so important for me that I wanted to, just made sense to now use that to guide what I do with myself and my activities. And then the other, then later, I discovered goodwill, or metta. And when I first started I did Zen first, and then when I first started doing Vipassana practice, these teachers were doing like guided loving kindness meditation. And at least for the kind of Zen that I was practicing back then, many years ago, this loving kindness was like, you don't do that in Zen. You just do the direct path to the truth, you know, and you just, you know, you're kind of serious and strict and direct and just sit in the truth. And any of this loving kindness, I just figured was just, you know, artificial and just excessively sweet and sentimental or something like that. And so in those early years of Vipassana practice, when teachers would do guided loving kindness meditation, in Zen we didn't do guided meditation, so that was also, I found, problematic. So I just did the reasonable thing. I just tuned them out. And that worked out pretty well until at some point, as my Vipassana practice opened up more and more, lo and behold, this new feeling arose, this powerful feeling in my chest arose that I kind of had never known in this kind of clarity. And then I said, oh, this is what they're talking about when they're doing this metta meditation. And after that, then metta became a nice thing, and metta meditation became something very significant for me, because now I had the reference point inside for it. Something had been awoken inside that, oh, now it's mine. It's not something from outside, because it would have been artificial for me, and maybe it would have been excessively sweet if I'd tried to do it without that reference point inside. And so this amazing goodness, this warmth, I think of it as, if the heart was kind of like a harp and with all these strings, if you take your fist and just kind of grab and hold tight all the strings, they don't resonate with anything. No music will come out of them. But if you can release the clutching of the heart, then all the strings of the heart can be played. But they also, there's something called if you're a musician, you probably know the expression better than me, something like syncretous resonance, that if one string is vibrating, strings near it might resonate a little bit to that string. And so there's a sense that the heart has all these strings that will resonate with what's around us and other people. And so if there's suffering or there's other things, sometimes it's the compassion string that resonates. Sometimes it's the goodwill and friendliness string that resonates. Sometimes it's the celebratory string of mudita, of sympathetic joy. And sometimes it's equanimity string that kind of vibrates. And but it really requires that the clutching, the gripping that we have in our minds and hearts, have stop gripping those strings or damping them down. Because those strings are very sensitive and maybe even shy. And so as we settle and settle and open and open, and it takes a while, it takes its time to discover this beautiful qualities. But the Buddha says here, he says, he doesn't say, go meditate discover, you know, loosen up these strings, get them tuned up so they resonate nicely, or discover that your compassion, discover your goodwill, and just keep meditating. He's talking about action here. Action is a little bit different than just sitting and just being with something. And there's something about acting that changes us. We are also transformed by what we do. We're not only transformed by, you know, what we be. And so to begin to appreciate the wonderfulness, the delightfulness, the value of friendliness, of goodwill, and then to don't just leave it to chance that at the appropriate time you'll feel goodwill, but also practice it. When you're in community, practice goodwill in body, speech, and mind. So do actions of goodwill and kindness. Maybe it can be as simple as opening a door for someone, or not so much to help them, but just to do a friendly thing, and or saying welcome to someone, or saying, you know, something you appreciate about them. So, you know, there's an infinite number of things we can do that express basic solidarity, basic companionship, basic friendliness, kindness, goodwill. Practice it, do it. That's how it gets stronger. That's how these strings get more and more, tune the strings finely in the heart. Get them really well tuned. You want to keep practicing it and doing it. And if you want to work through the places where the heart is still closed, kind of push gently against it by acting, by doing things that put you up against the edges of what you're comfortable with. Not to push yourself into situations which are not good for you, but rather to keep discovering, where can I open more? Where can I discover this more and more? And also, in this teaching here of the Buddha, practice these things so that you help create a better community, a more cohesive community, a more loving and respectful, mutually respectful community. If you are in a community or in a nation where there's a lot of disunity, where there's a lot of verbal daggers going on, it doesn't really help too much if you sit back and say, someone should do something about that. They should do it. It doesn't help your heart. What helps your heart is that you do something about it. And maybe you can't change a whole nation, but maybe you can change the people that you touch during the day by practicing in more kindness and generosity of spirit and goodwill. And And why would we do that? Why would we practice and live in a way caring for our community? I think because there's a reciprocal relationship and mutuality between our own well-being and the well-being of others. It's an ancient tradition in India that these are mutual, they're interrelated. You don't really have one without the other. The more deeply you can go into your own liberation, your own well-being, the more you become a source of well-being for society. And the more you support society, the more that comes back and supports you. And so, you know, it doesn't play out in all domains of social life, but it's maybe in communities we're really close enough in touch with each other. And so here in the story, it's with a monastic community. And and as we'll see, the last of these six delightful actions is deeply personal, and so it has to do with one's own liberation. But the consequence is that it's the very best way of creating love and respect and cohesion and concord and unity. And I think that one of the significant ways of learning how to release our attachments, release the ways in which we're caught, and really to free ourselves and find the capacity of deep peace, is to be actively contributing, not like exhaustingly, but to have in your mind in simple ways, and let it be kind of a normal, kind of almost maybe habitual, an ordinary, simple thing that you start living kindly with goodwill towards yourself and towards others. It's not only about you, it's not only about them, but it's about all of us together. And it's just as wonderful and profound and meaningful to start being more friendly towards oneself as it is to be more have goodwill towards others. And that, I would say, has also been one of the wonderful consequences for me of doing this practice that we're all doing this retreat, is that at some point I realized, to my surprise, that I had become my own friend. And now I actually like my company. That's a kind of a new thing, you know. Me and myself are friends now. I can say that. And I'm a friend with my mind. And someone asked me after a long retreat I did, what was your relationship to your thoughts, thinking? This is a person, I think, who had a lot of trouble with a lot of thinking on retreat and struggling with it. So he asked me, you know, what was your relationship to thinking? And without thinking about it, I said that, I had a friendly relationship to my thoughts. And I thought he was going to fall off his chair when I said that. He was like so shocked. It was like it came out of the left field for him. You know, being friendly towards your thoughts. So on this retreat, as you practice mindfulness, without a lot of effort and extra work, maybe there's a way that mindfulness itself can be an action, an activity of goodwill, of friendliness. Maybe mindfulness is as simple as the friendly interest to listen deeply to what's really here for you, and to listen below the protests, the criticism, the boredom, the pulling away, the distractions, the fears that kind of might be a little bit more surface stuff that keeps us from really settling and listening really deeply what's here. But to give ourselves the wonderful gift of listening, sensing, feeling ourselves very deeply as we can. What a wonderful, friendly thing to do. And it's an amazing piece of goodwill to do that for anybody, including for when we do it for ourselves. So finally I'll say that one of the reasons I like this sutta, this discourse, is that as a little bit of a corrective for sometimes a tendency in a meditation tradition like ours, where meditation is so personal and private, that we sometimes get the message that's the whole thing is just personal, and it supports a certain kind of individualism, and even sometimes a conceit. It's all about me, myself, and mine. But here we have a teaching that it's also about us, it's also about the community, and the two aren't so separate. And I hope that one of the gifts this practice brings you is you find a wonderful integration, a wonderful interpenetration of awakening with yourself and awakening with your social life and community life. May we be forces of goodwill in this world, practicing publicly and privately. And now we're all on these Zoom tiles. What a great time to do it privately to your community. May each of you practice on this retreat for your own welfare and happiness, and for the welfare and happiness of everyone here who's practicing together. I delight in our being together. Thank you.